There is something strangely uncomfortable when we come together for the annual Passover service. Washing one another's feet does not seem to be the problem. I'm speaking personally here. It may not be for you. But there is just a part of this that, I guess uncomfortable is the word. We seem to gladly wash each other's feet. It breaks up the concentration, the focus that makes us all a little uncomfortable is something else. It's the next part. It's the bread and the wine to me. Up until that point, the bread is on the table, all covered as it should be. Then we come to this place in the service, similar to what Jesus did. He took bread and he blessed it, and he said to them, "Take, eat, this is my body." Now, I don't know about you, but whenever the bread is there, it's a crisp piece of bread, just like this. But whenever it's broken, I kind of wince a little bit. It kind of gets to you. I asked my wife this morning, "Would you bake a piece of this bread?" I see it's already been broken. It was in my briefcase, but doesn't sound very nice, does it? That's what we do. There was this discussion on one of the forums as to various types of bread that a person ought to bake for the Passover, and we suggested that it ought to be crisp because if you are, administering the Passover to a number of people, you can't have soft bread. You know, for a dozen people, that's fine. You can make unleavened bread soft, by the way. We make it crisp because it's a lot easier to break for, say, 50 to 60 to 80 to 100 people. You just have to do this. So, and it breaks. Jesus said that. He said, "With fervent desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." He tore it in pieces. The bread, gave it to his disciples. He knew in a few hours that it would mean untold suffering for him. Now, as we read in the 22nd chapter of Luke, and Luke seems to give quite a comprehensive view of this particular of the Passover. Mark's and Matthew's is a little bit shorter, and Paul takes his from Luke. Naturally, as he would, because Paul was more closely associated with Luke. Luke traveled with him. When the hour had come, he sat down with the 12 apostles with him, and he said to them, "With fervent desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." Now, this is interesting here because he said suffer, and suffering has to do with the Passover. "I will no longer eat of it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God." And then he took the cup and gave thanks and said, "Take, eat, divide it amongst yourselves. For I say to you, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes." Now that's not the order. That's simply the explanation. Verse 19 is the actual order. Okay, just to clarify that particular point, because people say, "Well, wait a minute, it seems to be in a different order than what you do." And no, you do an examination of all the scriptures, and you'll see just the way we do it is the order of the Passover. And he took bread, gave thanks, and broke it. He broke it, just like I did that piece of bread with you. This is not the Passover bread, by the way. Passover bread has to be blessed and used at that particular evening for that particular purpose. This is just a piece of bread we baked this morning, still good to eat, didn't bless it, doesn't represent the body of Christ. I simply wanted to say, it's broken, boom, and it makes this kind of a noise. But it represents something whenever you do, the person who's administering it actually breaks it. Verse 19, "And he took bread, gave thanks, and broke it," it says, "and gave it to them, saying, 'This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me.'" There's something about doing something in remembrance of Christ, and especially something that we are supposed to remember about him. Now, Paul says very clearly that it is to remember his death until he comes. But it also has to do with suffering. With suffering. And he alludes to that here. There's something about the suffering of Christ that changes everything. The bread represents his body that is broken for you. Some people say, well, that just refers to the bread that was broken. But it's a terrible thing to have happen to you. And the body, one might say, is broken, even though no bones were broken. We know that in the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. But his flesh was torn. It was ripped, and it was quite bad. But we have to ask the question, why did Jesus the Christ, the Messiah, have to suffer? Why did it have to be that way? After all, the next symbol, the wine, represents the shed blood. This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for you, that he says in verse 20. I don't know if I read that or not. I don't think I did, but he just simply took a cup. He took it after supper. And so he's there eating, and out of the blue, he does these two things. He picks up some bread, he breaks it, and he passes it to each of his disciples, and he says, I want you to take this. He says, this is my body. He says, now, this is what I want you to do. And so they were eating a lamb. They were sitting there with a meal, with all of everything that went with it. They were reclining, as is normally done amongst the Jews at the time, when they ate. And there was a table that was set, a very low set table, and they were in quite close communion with each other. They could hear each other talking and speaking. And out of it, Jesus says, and I suppose when he speaks, everybody kind of went quiet. They said, well, okay, what's he saying? Picks up the bread, breaks it. And he says, this is my body. Now, this was a rather strange thing for him to do. And it was unexpected. Even though they had heard so many things about Jesus being the bread of life, as we read, some almost 2 years earlier, he's speaking of this. But yet, it's something that is quite startling when he does this. Then he takes a cup with wine in it, and he passes it around. He says, drink out of it, all of you. And they all had a sip of it, passed it back around. I guess it came to Jesus, and I assume he did it because he says, I won't be doing it anymore until the kingdom of heaven, to with you in the kingdom of heaven. So I assume he took a sip of the same cup. In other words, they all shared in the very same thing. Now, but he suffered. Here's the point we want to come to today. He suffered. Now, I realize that is somewhat emphasized, but I'll tell you what is also emphasized and something that we got to be very careful about, and that is the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead is normally emphasized after Good Friday, as it is, even this year. That resurrection, or that is Easter Sunday, is approached almost with a euphoria. They say it in some kind of a mystical way. Well, he is risen, you know. He's risen, like it's some real thing. And it was. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that. But this has become the same. It's become a celebration. It turns into a holiday representing anything from new life to any other pagan idea that you want to throw in about the resurrection. But it's very interesting. God never tells us to celebrate his resurrection. Jesus Christ was declared to be a son of God by or through the resurrection of the dead. And that was the sign that he gave people, that he would be resurrected from the dead. After 3 days and three nights, he would be raised from the grave. However, nowhere does it say you ought to memorialize it or that it should become a celebration. But Paul explained it this way. If you want to go to 1 Corinthians chapter 5, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, where you have The Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread referred to by Paul to the church in Corinth. He says in verse 7 and 8, "Therefore purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you are truly unleavened," for that means they had already removed the leaven out. "For indeed Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us, therefore let us keep the feast." So he says, indeed Christ our Passover is sacrificed for us, therefore let us keep the feast. What do you do once you understand that Christ has been sacrificed? You keep the feast. That's what it says. It's very clear here as to what he wants you to do here. Keep the feast. Now he goes on to say, therefore, let us keep the feast. Not, verse 8, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Now, unleavened bread represents the body of Christ and also is eaten for 7 days following the Passover. So it's very important to know that we have something that represents the body of Christ, certainly the life of Christ, and it is eaten for 7 days. We read this with respect to the Passover, John 6:51. John 6:51. We will read this during the Passover. But to eat the bread, John 6:51, "I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I shall give is my flesh, which I shall give for the life of the world." Jesus clearly says he is the bread of life. We understand that whenever we take that little bit of bread, I've got the pieces here now, that on that evening, that bread would be representing the body of Jesus Christ. And he says to eat it. And the fact that you accept that then means that he is now imparting to you life. You have life. Now, what kind of life? Not just human life, but now you have eternal life then inherent within you, and that is Jesus. You have feasted upon, it is called the feast, Jesus Christ, and it is through him then that you live. You do not have the means to live for eternity. You do not of yourself have eternal life, but it is something that it is given to us through this symbolic thing that we do on the Passover, and that is we take that bread. He also says, "I am the true bread." He says in another place, I thought it was in verse 30. "I am the bread of life," verse 35. And he says in verse 33, "For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." And Jesus Christ is that bread. Now, suffering is always a time of truth. In suffering, and this is something that I don't know if we've thought about it before, and to me, this is why it is something that whenever I see that bread on the plate and I'm supposed to break it, which I do, ask God to bless it, there's something there that kind of gets to you a little bit. Hopefully we've thought about it beforehand, and that's the whole object of the sermon today, is to think about this, to consider this before we take the Passover, so that we can be properly prepared for it. And I want to cover it this way by saying suffering is always a time of truth. In suffering, there is no deceit. In suffering, there is nothing false. When a person suffers, you know exactly what the person is. It reveals all. Now, there is only one reason why I'm here today, is because Jesus suffered. And not just died and was resurrected. Now, though I've given sermons on the resurrection before, and the fact that everything that took place and that what the disciples believed was because he was resurrected. Now, that's a part of it. But I also want to say that it wasn't just a matter that he was resurrected, but that he also suffered. Not just died, resurrected, and was resurrected, but he suffered. Now, let me explain it this way to you, and I tried perhaps to figure out the best way to explain it to you today. But when I learned what he did, and that is suffering, when I understood that, that made all the difference to me. Now, did I know the truth before? Absolutely, I knew the truth before. I had grown up with a father who did everything he could to try to tell me what the truth was, and he really did. He would come home, and on the weekends we would sit down, and I remember as in my young teenage years, he would try, I use the word try, to get the points across to my brother and myself, and then my sister who would come along after, and we would always sit and listen respectfully, because if we didn't, my dad was 6'4". He was bigger than I was. He taught us a lot of moves. He knew them. And I always knew he didn't teach us all of them. We were respectful. We sat and we listened for about an hour. Sometimes it was a couple of hours on the Sabbath. There was no local church around for us to go to. So we listened to what Dad had to say. He would read articles out of the Plain Truth magazine, or he would read the correspondence course. Did I know the truth? Yes, I knew the truth. Was I going to do what the truth said? No. Did I believe all the other churches were right? Absolutely not. I knew what they were. We had all that figured out. But neither was I going to knuckle under and do what I was supposed to do. Now, that's simply the way it was growing up. So, I did learn a lot from other people outside of my own family, outside of my father. I do respect now what he did and what he tried to do. But it's when I got involved with other young people in the church that I saw, wow, you know, they've got something going for themselves. But then something else happened. I'm sitting in the life and teachings class, the one that I'm going through with you today. And the instructor back then was Dr. Meredith, and he was going through what a crucifixion is like. He was going through what scourging was all about. And he did this in one class period. Well, sometime before then, one of my friends, one of my buddies, was baptized. He never told me about it. And I just happened to be walking along the lower gardens, and I saw him being baptized. And it was a shock. I says, him? So anyway, I talked to him later, and I said, well, what's this baptism thing? So he tried to explain it to me, and he explained it all to me, quite well, in fact. But that didn't do anything to me. I'm sitting there in class, and I'm hearing him go through what a scourging is, why he had to do this. What did it mean for me personally? He was getting to me. Now, that made the difference. That made the difference. Why? You see, when you know that somebody did that for you, not just die. We're not talking about just simply dying. You know, a person can go to sleep and die and be resurrected 3 days later. That's not what happened. He suffered. What does suffering do? That proved to me, personally, more than anything else, that he absolutely meant what he said. And that he had to be true. This was truth. Suffering brings out truth. It does, you know. It always does. he couldn't have expressed a certain sincerity. He couldn't. And you know, why does it say here, we just read it, keep the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth? Do you ever think about that? The unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. You don't have any choice but to say that, considering who he was, we've given sermons on that before, considering here he was the creator of this entire universe, here he was the person, then the second member of the Godhead, if I can put it that way, they both coexisted together, and so in terms of their existence, they were the same, exactly the same. One chose to be in submission to the other. That was his choice. That's something they fully agreed to. And he came and gave himself. And we say, sure, it was the Father's decision, but it was also his decision. It says he gave himself. It says the Father gave him. It says it both ways. They were both in a full agreement with what they did. And why were they in agreement? Because that's what they were. I mean, the Son revealed the Father in every way and in every sense. This is what they were. It's something that was simply going to happen because they had embarked upon a plan. They wanted to share their existence with other people. They also knew that somehow the loyalty of those children that he would beget had to be assured forever. Now, how was that going to happen? Well, we had to be absolutely convinced that this person was absolutely genuine, absolutely sincere, and nothing does this like suffering. It's got to be true. It has to be true. There's no guesswork in this. Now, it's true when you know he was resurrected, because God wouldn't resurrect somebody. But look, this is something that he knew was going to happen. It's something that he chose for himself to do. Yes, he did. And when a person does that, how can I, and who am I, to question his motives? I can't do that. So, yeah, I'm sitting there in this class, and I'm listening. And I made a decision. Right there. Didn't take long. About a split second. I knew. Because that's what suffering does. It brings you to a certain attachment to the person, because he's going through something here. But what he's going through here is something for you. So when I learned what he did, when I saw and understood the suffering, he proved to me his total and complete sincerity. And proving everything he said then was absolutely true. There was no decision left to make. I mean, it was there. It was so clear. Now, John 14, verse 6. John 14, verse 6, he says, and Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Now, he was the truth. It's not just said he spoke truth, or he taught truth, or he was a great teacher of truth. He was the truth. He was it, the truth. Now, for his If he went to sleep and he was awoken in a resurrection 3 days and three nights later, yep, I would be impressed. I would probably have made a difference in me. But this, the suffering, the torture, the pain, that's a different matter. Now, for his disciples, it would be a time of truth. What would they do? Would they stand with him? Would they suffer with him? Would they give their life for him, for them? Would they give their life for him, rather, and each other? Now, the truth is, they wouldn't. So, what would all the teaching and all the example he set do for them? Putting it all together, they would see it. They would get it. Eventually, they would. They would see the person who had no personal designs to exalt himself, no desire for them to promote him in their eyes, no manipulating them or using them, no selfish ambitions on his part. They would see someone so gracious, so forgiving, so understanding of their weaknesses that in spite of the fact that he knew what they would do, that he loved them. And he says he loved them until the end, we're told. Jesus washed their feet. What was he doing? Was that for show? Was that just, oh, that's just something you do and you don't have to worry about it later on? No. He went in and he did that. Because that's the way he lived. That's the way he always lived. They could have done it. They didn't do it. They walked in the room. There was the water. There was the basin. He pours it. He just gets up. Doesn't announce it. Just gets up. And he goes to each one of them. Picks up the dirty, dusty feet of each of them together. Kind of washes their feet. Rubs them down with the water. Just like we do. And takes all the dust, this dust, not the clean feet we come to Passover with. They were dirty feet. Rubs around between the toes, takes a towel, dries them, goes to each one. I suppose it was quite a moment when he comes to Judas. Doesn't hesitate, washes his feet. Just like he washed the rest of them. Doesn't make a distinction. He goes around, and then he says, you understand what's happening here? You understand what I've done to you? He says. And he talks about them being cleansed by him. He talks about being a servant. Two big lessons out of the foot washing. He starts telling them about this, how it is to serve one another. He says, this is what the Son of Man does. And he says, this is what, of course, you ought to do. Now, those feet Jesus washed, the very creator of the universe would wash those feet. Those same feet would, very shortly, take them as far away from Jesus as they could get. But because he washed them, and then he suffered, those same feet would take him right back to him again. And it did. He knew the power of sacrifice. He knew it would get to them. He knew it would bring them right back to where they belong, with him. And they would go all the way for him. When Jesus told the disciples about what was going to happen, it was hard to take. At first, they didn't understand why, but it was the only thing that would make any difference in their lives. Even the wrong understanding about who he was, that is, as a king, they thought, rightly so, but he wasn't going to come and be a king then. That is, a king in the sense that he would establish a kingdom on this earth at this time, and the way a kingdom is normally set up, he wouldn't be doing that. Didn't make a bit of difference to them. That is, having the hero, their king, being sent from God wouldn't change them. Gave them goosebumps, didn't change them. You see, it's something you have to experience. Either you have to experience it yourself. I'm talking about suffering. Or you have to be in the presence of one who himself suffers. Now, God says for us to experience this once a year. He says, I want you to think about it. I want you to let it sink in. He's not going to let you get away from it. He says, I'm going to do this in a certain way. We observe this in a particular way because we understand this is for you, commemorate his death. We don't put music in this. It'd be nice to have music, wouldn't it? It would be a distraction from something terrible. It would be something, well, we can get our minds off of this now and don't have to worry about that. No, it keeps you focused on it. We do it in a sober way, as we should. We don't bring music into it. Music is an interlude. He said, stay focused. Break the bread. Break it. Take it and eat it. I want you to chew it up. I want you to get it on the inside of you. And I want you to understand this is what happened. We are brought face to face as best we can under the circumstances some 2,000 years later by taking bread that symbolizes his body. And he says, I want you to do it every year. Not four times a year. Not every Sunday, every other Sunday, or whatever. Once a month Sunday with chopped up white bread, little cubes. You ever done that? I did. Used to do that. They'd pass it around on the Sundays in a little plate, take the white bread. This is hard, unleavened bread. Broken. Once a year. Not too many times to where it loses its value or its significance in our minds, but enough to bring it back to us all the time. Do you have to have this brought back to you? Absolutely, you do. You absolutely have to have this done. And it does make a difference. We got to stay on track. There's too many people who simply lost some of the ideas about this, and they're not on track anymore. They forget what they were. They forget what they used to be. They forget why their sins are forgiven. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 52 and 53. Now there's a lot in the Bible about this particular thing as to what it does. Isaiah 52. Verse 13. Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and very high. And just as many as were astonished at you, his visage was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. And so shall he sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths at him, for what has not been told them, they shall see. And what they had not heard, they shall consider. So kings, who were so exalted in their own minds, in their own eyes, in the way they, because, you know, they rule, they're great, they have powers. This is what a king does. He does have powers of life and death. And they talk a lot. And they like to hear other people talk about them and how important they are. And a person can prove his loyalty, as it were, by singing the praises of the king. And you better do this if you're the subject of a king. And there are certain words that you even say when you come into the presence of a king. Kings are going to shut their mouths. That's what it says. They're going to see what this person did. They're going to shut their mouths. Verse 1 of chapter 53. Who has believed our report? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He shall grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of dry ground. He has no form or comeliness. When we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. We like to think on a different level. You notice all of the ads about nice Christian people in Christian churches are all happy all the time. You ever see an ad for a Christian church with a frown? Oh no, you got to be strung out on happiness all the time. Celebration. And you're really just emotionally strung out all the time. And if you're not, well, you got to go Sunday morning and you got to get into some kind of real emotional type of a group. Get yourself charged up again. And so everybody's happy, happy, happy. You know, God holds our feet to the fire once a year. You come to the Passover service, you sit, you got to face it, you got to see it. It's got to be brought right back home to you. He doesn't let us off the hook. He says, you've got to see this. You got to do this. Okay. And you got to do the hard thing. A lot of people don't want to do the hard thing. But we do have to face these things. So we have this description. Surely he has borne our griefs, that is our sicknesses, carried our sorrows, that is our pain. And we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted, but he was wounded for our transgressions. We don't want to face that. That's hard to face. Because, oh, well, he had to have done something wrong. You see, we don't want to face the fact that he was doing this to bring something home to us. And it's hard. Sure it is. It's hard to face the awful truth of the matter. Remember what I said to start with? Suffering means truth. Suffering is coming to the truth. Suffering means you come to the truth of the matter. Always. In the deepest sense. What do people don't want to do? To come to the truth sometimes is so terrible. It's so terrible. They don't want to see it. Look, I'll just give you a very brief example here. In 2008, people did not want to face the awful truth. You go back to the year 2000, and there was this something exuberance. What did Greenspan call it? Something. Anyway, people didn't want to believe this. I'm talking about from an economic point of view. That it just goes on and on and on. The housing bubble goes up. This bubble goes up. That bubble goes up. Everything just keeps going. Why? It's just got to keep going. And the awful truth is, I mean the awful truth, is it's not going to be this way. Don't we understand? Hard to face truth. One of the most difficult things in the world to face. So, oh yeah, we're brought right back to the bread every year. As to what he was doing. He was wounded for our transgressions. We can't come up with some idea like it suggests here that why he must have done something wrong. Why we like to come up with that because we find an answer, don't we? That kind of satisfies things a little bit. At least we find some kind of an explanation for it. Not so. The chastisement. Let's say he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace, was upon him. By his stripes we're healed. Oh, is that so? That's what it says. And it really means that. By his stripes we're healed. We are like sheep have gone astray. Why, we wouldn't do anything like this. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Does he want you to understand that? Yes. How can he do this? One way. Only one way. He was oppressed and he was afflicted. Yet he opened not his mouth, and he was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as sheep before his shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Let me ask you this. Here was Jesus. What if he would have been arrested, not knowing what was happening to him, and went kicking and screaming and cursing? What would that do for you? Not very much. No. Here was a person, it says here, he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb, led to the slaughter. Let's go back and see something here. We're going to come back here in a moment. Matthew 26, verse 31. Let's just see how silent he was. And let's see, on the other hand, how boisterous someone else was. Matthew 26, 31. Then Jesus said to them, this was after the Passover is over, and they sung a hymn. They went out to the Mount of Olives. Then Jesus said to them, all of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it is written, and he quotes the Bible, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee. And Peter answered and said to him, even if all, probably waved his hand to point out all these other guys here, even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble. And Jesus said to him, assuredly I say to you that this night before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. And Peter said, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. And so said all of the disciples. Well, they didn't want to be left out, did they? And so, anyway, Jesus simply has to overlook that. And so he goes to the garden. And he takes Peter with him, for that matter. And he hears. And Peter hears what he has to say, to some extent. And Peter, we see Matthew recording it, Luke recording it, Mark, to some extent, recording that. I will not deny you. True or false? Absolutely false. Did Peter believe it was truth? Absolutely, he believed it was the truth. But it was false. Completely. Luke 22, verse 54. Let's see what happened. Luke 22:54. Having arrested him, they led him, 22:54 of Luke, and brought him into the high priest's house. But Peter followed at a distance. And when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them. And a certain servant girl, seeing him as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him and said, this man was also with him. But he denied him, saying, woman, I do not know him. And after a little while, another saw him and said, you are of them. But Peter said, man, I am not. And after about an hour passed, another confidently affirmed, saying, surely this fellow who was with him, for he is a Galilean. And Peter said, man, I do not know what you're saying. And immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed, just like Jesus said. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. And so Peter went out and wept bitterly. What's going on here? He saw truth in the face of suffering. He saw truth. He came to truth in a way that, in one sense, you got to feel sorry for him. But he was so vehement that he would never do it. You know, I know that we have a certain opinion of ourselves. We all do. Nobody's exempt from this. It does say the human heart is what? Deceitful, above all things, desperately wicked. And when we read that, we probably say, yeah, I sort of know kind of that way, but it applies mainly to other people. Right? Right. And then we go on, and that was back in Jeremiah's time, and we have Jesus now. Well, here I was, in the face of suffering, not speaking. Nothing said. Peter looks at him. Peter's the one who's doing the denying, just like he said. Jesus simply looks at him across through the crowd and takes a look. That's all he's got to do. That's it. He had been accused, been condemned, been shoved around, arrested wrongly. Oh, the worst was yet to come. Peter saw himself. That's what it takes. You've got to hold a person's feet to the fire. And we do. We can't get out of it. We've got to see it for what it is. And we can't be a person out here so taken up with our own goodness, our own righteousness, because we're either in the church, or we know this, or we know that, or we have more knowledge than everybody else, and we make fun of everybody else, and we carry on, and we make judgments, and we make these value statements, we say a lot of things about ourselves. I will never do this, and I will never do that. Not a good thing to do. Jesus says, I am the truth. We just read that. I am the truth. Not Peter. Not any of the other disciples. I am the truth. You see, when you come in contact with Jesus Christ in the way that they did and what they saw, there's only one thing that was going to get to them. Jesus' suffering. They had to see it, and they had to experience it, and they had to be there when it happened. Oh yeah, they fled, because they weren't going to be arrested. They weren't going to stand by him, which tells them something about themselves. They all did that, but they all had to do this. But they were hanging around. When it came time to the crucifixion, they were there. Were they there in the crowd when Pilate was bringing him out, beaten, scourged, accused, looking terrible? Yeah, they had to see it. He wasn't going to let them get away with this. They had to see it. And they had to feel it. And they had to be with him. You see, it comes to the point where nothing else matters. To us, plenty matters. We don't get what we think we should get. To us, that matters. People are hurt when somebody insults them or accused falsely. We might tend to give in to temptation. It matters to us who is the greatest, doesn't it? As it did the disciples right during the time of the Passover. They argued about who's going to be the greatest. Jesus, he places all things in the hands of the Father. He was content. He was at peace. How would you like to live that way? You have to come to truth. Absolute truth. Brutal? Yes. Tough? Yes. But you got to come to the truth. And you have to see it for what it is. You are content. You're secure. You place yourself in the hands, not just of someone who is greater, but someone whom you can trust. How many people have that? That's what he's asking us to do. And this is what suffering does. When you see that, you know that's what you can do. Absolutely, you know this is what you can do. How many have the ability to confront the truth? How many? How many pass it by? How many resort to accepting the status quo? We say, well, that's just the way it is. Peter had to confront truth. We are all exactly where we are now because, to some degree, we have not confronted the awful truth. When you do, you're free. A lot of us aren't free. Sure, I can say that. A lot of us aren't free. And the way you're going to be free, you got to confront the truth. And it's hard. The hardest thing that you'll ever do. Peter had to do that. You see, without Jesus and without his suffering, I would never know truth. I would play games with myself. I would tell lies to myself. I would just build a lot of things up in my head, and I would say, that's truth. I would say I would never do this and never do that. I would have certain opinions of myself. Easy to do. All changes in the face of suffering. Jesus said this, John 14, verse 6. I didn't read this part to you. He said, no one comes to the Father except by me. That's right. No one comes to the Father except by me. And this is what it means. It means you got to come to see and understand the kind of truth we're talking about here and come to that. And when we talk about truth, we talk about, well, the truth of God's church. The truth of the true doctrines. A lot of people can do that. You can get on the internet. You can find all that sort of stuff. That's not what Peter had to come to. Peter said, I know that you are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. He said, do you really? Okay, here's what's going to happen. The Son of Man's going to be arrested. He's going to be tortured and suffer, and he's going to be put to death. No! Wait a minute, I thought you said you knew who I was. Hard to come to the truth. Very hard. First, John 1, verse 17. John 1, 17. For the law was given through Moses. But grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Does that mean the law wasn't truth? No, it doesn't mean that at all. It talks about truth on a personal basis. Personally, you and me, can we come to truth? And we can only come to truth when grace is involved. How so? I think if you thought about it for about 20 seconds, you'd come up with the answer yourself. And that you realize you got to have grace. But you got to come to the truth of the matter. You got to see what it is we really are. And then we realize, I got to have truth. That's why it says grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Isaiah 53 again, verse 9. Let's go back to Isaiah 53. This is to me, it's very revealing. I hope it is to you. Isaiah 53, verse 8 and 9. Just to take up where we left off a moment ago. He was taken from prison and from judgment, and who will declare his generation? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was stricken. And they made his grave with the wicked, but with the rich at his death, because he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. We have an extraordinary person here. No deceit. Everything he said was true. 1 Peter chapter 2, 22. 1 Peter 2, 22. Now, this is what really gets to you. Who committed no sin, as it says, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he had suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously, who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed. For you were like sheep going astray, but now you have returned to the shepherd and the overseer of your souls. And just like the feet that left Jesus, now they returned. They wouldn't have. if he would have reviled, if he would have threatened, if he would have cursed Pilate, if he would have cursed the people who were beating him and scourging him and nailing his wrist to the beams, that wouldn't have done any good. He had to do it this way. Everything he professes, this is the way he really was. This was it. This is the way he really is and always was, all the way back through all eternity. This is the way he will be for all eternity in the future. I can count on that. You got me. I can make a decision on that. Oh, is it a logical? Absolutely, it's a logical decision. But it's an emotional one, too. Because it gets me. Does it get you? This is when you make these kinds of decisions. When you see, deep down, really, the kind of person he really was. Revelation 14, verse 5. Now, this is interesting. It speaks of the first fruits who were redeemed from among men. They are the first fruits to God and to the Lamb. Verse 4, it says. And in their mouth was found no deceit, for they are without fault before the throne of God. Why are they without fault? We say, well, because they've been forgiven. I want to tell you something. These people have been brought to truth, to absolute, pure truth. That's why they're there. They don't kid themselves. They don't try to kid other people. They don't try to do a con job on you. That's exactly what they are. And that's why they're exactly where they say, where it says they should be. With him. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 27. Now we come to something that we normally read. But let's see what we're talking about here. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 27. He gives the instructions of the Passover, finishes that with the Corinthians. And then he says this. 1 Corinthians 11, 27. For whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. So if you do this in such a way where you don't consider what you're doing, and I'll tell you in just a moment, because right toward the end of the passage here, it tells you how they were doing this in an unworthy manner, but they will be guilty of the body of the blood of the Lord. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of that bread and drink of the cup. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. You know, you really want to discern the Lord's body. You want to be able to know, well, what happened? What did he do? Why did he do it? Does it make any difference? It sure does make a difference. Now, a person has to examine himself, and it's such a momentous thing. You could be guilty, then, of the body of the Lord. I skipped the blood of the Lord because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the body. That's the subject today. For this reason, many are weak and sick among you, and many sleep. For if we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged. But when we are judged, we are chastened by the Lord, that we may not be condemned with the world. Wherefore, my brethren, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. Now, they weren't waiting for one another. Look, everybody's there at the same basis. They were there because they had to have their sins forgiven in exactly the same way. Nobody was any different than anybody else. When you walked into the room and you partook of the table of the Lord, that is the Passover. It says you do it together. It's important you do it together. You're all doing this on the basis of the fact you are all equally in need of the forgiveness of sins. Not anybody is any different than anybody else. In their minds, somebody was different. That's what happened. Some people thought that after a while, Christ's body was more for other people, sinners, other sinners. After all, look at the state of affairs in the Corinthian church. Why would you do this? Why would you be discriminatory? Why would you have cliques and groups and this and that and carrying on? Well, you had certain attitudes. So he says, I want you to examine yourself. Okay, what does examine yourself mean? Let's take a look at this. Acts chapter 22, 24. The commander ordered him to be bought, to be brought into the barracks. This is Paul now. Acts 22, 24. The commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks and said that he should be examined under scourging, so that he might know why they shouted so against him. Always gets the truth, is what he's saying. I will get to the truth of the matter, the commander says, and I'll do it through scourging, and this is how we will examine this person. Verse 29, and immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him. And the commander was also afraid after he found out that he was a Roman because he had bound him. And then the next day, because he wanted to know for certain why he was accused by the Jews, he released him from his bonds and commanded the chief priest and all their council to appear and brought Paul down and set him before them. Let me just make an observation and a comment here. It would be better if we just sat down and we asked ourselves some questions. That's what he's asking us to do. This is why we are given this once a year. And as we've seen the years go by, we understand that some people, and perhaps quite a few people, don't appreciate why Christ suffered. And you know, there's no more guilt in their mind. Well, guilt is one thing. I'm sorry, I used the wrong word there. There's no more conscience in the sense that Jesus died for them as much as he did anybody else. Some people might say, well, I've moved on. Some people might say, well, I've been in this for 40-some years. It's only other people. They need to understand this. How did that happen? How do people forget that what's happened to them once? I remember that moment. I know it. I visualize it. And I've never forgotten it. And every year, I'm brought back to it again with that. Can't get away from it. I might want to, but I can't. He tells me I got to keep the Passover. He tells me I got to take that bread and I got to break it. He tells me I got to give it to you. And that plate comes around. You got to take a look at that bread. And you got to think about what it means. We all think about what it means sometime before that. But years don't go by and we forget about it. He says, every year you do this. And we're brought right back to it again. Luke 7, verse 36. Then one of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him. Luke 7, 36. And he went to the Pharisee's house and sat down to eat. Behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil. Verse 38. And stood at his feet behind him weeping, and she began to wash his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head, and she kissed his feet and anointed them with fragrant oil. And the Pharisee who had invited him saw this. He spoke to himself, saying, this man, if he were a prophet, would know who and what manner of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. And Jesus answered and said to him, Simon, I have something to say to you. And so he said, teacher, say it. And there was a certain creditor who had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and another 50. And when they had nothing with which to repay, he freely forgave them both. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him more? And Simon answered and said, I suppose the one whom he forgave more. And he said, you have rightly judged. And then he turned to the woman and said to Simon, do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has washed my feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. You gave me no kiss, but this woman has not ceased to kiss my feet since the time I came in. You did not anoint my head with oil, but this woman has anointed my feet with fragrant oil. Therefore, I say to you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little. Does this explain why some people forget the fact that they were forgiven? They forget about God. They forget about God's laws. They forget about God's ways. They say, I don't have to do this anymore. They do. They never, if they ever did, they forgot it. But I'm suspecting that somewhere along the line, they never came face to face with the kind of suffering that Jesus experienced. Now, I haven't seen the Passion of Christ. Just a decision I made. That's a personal decision, by the way. Not saying one way or the other. A person can do that if they want to. I wanted to read as much as I could, understand it, and I let my imagination do the rest. That's all I needed. I want to stay with that. You don't have to. That's the way I did it. It may help you to see it. So I'm not expressing an opinion one way or the other. I'm just saying when you're there and when you see something, it did make a difference to the apostles. And they stayed with Christ forever. They didn't depart from it. Yeah, John came to the foot of the cross. He stayed there. He saw it. He was standing with Mary. She never forgot. The other ones were around. They came by. They saw it. They had to. You don't just walk away from that. You had to feel this whole thing. You had to know he was put in the grave. And it stayed with them. And they referred to it. Peter certainly did over and over again. And it made all the difference to him. No, it's not pleasant. No, it's not nice. It's terrible. It's awful, in fact. I got this thing on scourging. I just pulled it off the internet. You can do the same thing if you want to. What did I do with it? The Scourging of Jesus, put out by, if I'm not mistaken, the Church of Christ. Now, I'm not going to read it here. It would disrupt the services too much if I did. Because somebody just might have to walk out and leave or whatever. I don't say that lightly, but I mean, it's bad. It's worse than you can ever imagine. But you begin to see what he did. You begin to see truth in a way that it would come out that is so profound that you'll never see truth like this again. Therefore, I say to you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much, but to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little. You really have to see and understand. You have to understand that, what you've done. And you just can't flip it off. You really can't. Ephesians 4:20, let me just conclude here with a couple of points here. Ephesians 4:20, but you have not so learned Christ. Comes back to him. Every time, all the time, comes right back to him. You can't get away from it. If indeed you have heard him and have been taught by him as the truth is in Jesus. Not what I think's the truth, not your opinion of the truth, but the truth as it is in Jesus. And if you were there, And you could see the word of truth, as John himself said in 1 John chapter 1. It says, we have seen, chapter 1, verse 1. We have heard, we have seen with our eyes, we have looked upon, our hands have handled concerning the word of life, and his life was manifested to us, and we have seen this. And he said, that's who my fellowship is with. He says, Paul says, Ephesians 4:20, but you have not so learned Christ. If indeed you have heard him and have been taught by him as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off concerning the former conduct, the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts. I couldn't be the same kind of person I was before. I couldn't just flip it off like I always did. Because nothing bad was happening to me. I had my whole life in front of me. I couldn't do this anymore. Couldn't kid myself anymore. And be renewed in the spirit of your mind, that you put on the new man which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. Therefore, putting away lying, let each of you speak truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. What you see is what you get. I hope it's that way. I hope it's that way more and more. I hope we're not kidding ourselves, and I hope we're not kidding other people. It's very disappointing sometimes to find that, wow, the person's having me on all this time. I didn't know that. Can we be open? Can we be clear? I don't have a problem if somebody's got a problem. That's not a problem to me. It can be a bad problem. I mean, it could be worse than what anybody. That's, to me, it's not a problem. You know what's worse? Cover up. Making like this is not really the way it is. Being hypocritical. Jesus had a big problem with that one. Let each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor. I can handle it when a person's got a problem. I can handle that. I really can. But I can't handle when somebody is going to lie to me. And it's a cover-up. And they're trying to make me think there's something that they're not. I say, and I threaten to do this, and I think one time I did say it to a person who was just really carrying on about what he believed and what he knew and how much knowledge he had. I looked him in the eye and I said, come, go with me. Let's go die together for Christ. Come on. Right now, let's go. Well, you soon find out what the person's like. So, let each of you speak the truth with his neighbor. See, we come to truth. Sometimes it's our suffering. I was going to read to you Hebrews chapter 12. Time's getting on. Perhaps we'll finish up with Job, the 42nd chapter. Maybe it's a place to go here. Job answered the Lord and said, let me give you a hint. When the Lord is asking you some questions, and he's asking you questions all the time, by the way. Yes, he is. When Job answered the Lord and said, I know you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Who's this in the big cover-up? God was asking Job. Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. And I have heard you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Yeah, I get the point. I see what you're saying. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. Now, Job suffered. He says, God God scourges. The Son in whom he delights. That's what the Greek word means. He delights. That's the Son he scourges. He delights in that Son. If he doesn't delight in you, he's not even going to worry about you. But he will scourge. That is, examine. Bring to truth. Bring to the point to where you're going to see it the way he sees it. Now, this is a process that we go through. It's a process we go through every year. And we do this, and the only way we can do this is that we have to look straight into the eyes of truth. And that is into the eyes of Jesus Christ. It's the only one. He is the truth. We have to understand the truth as it is in Jesus. And allow him to simply convict us, as Peter was convicted. When you consider what he did, and when you consider who he was, and you consider what he went through, and you consider the absolute purity of his attitude and his motive, I throw in the towel. You got me.